You're listening to the 20th episode of the Armand and Akil Show, bringing you interviews with local activists, politicians, and policy experts from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland, and today beyond. I'm Akil Krishnan.
And I'm Armand Rana. We're recording this on Saturday, the 5th of October, 2024, at about 5.02 p.m. We are broadcasting live from UBC's Vancouver campus, located on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Han Communion-speaking Musqueam people.
Armand, how's it going?
It's all right. Yeah, been door-knocking a lot for a particular candidate in the BC election. Just want to give a shout-out to make sure that everybody is getting ready to vote. Election day is October 19th. And yeah, it's a super important election. If you look at the polls, it's super close, so do get informed and, yeah, do make sure to get your voice heard.
Absolutely. And advance voting does open on October 10th, and you are able to still request a mail-in ballot if that is what you'd like to do.
Yeah.
You know, maybe you're away or you're busy that day.
Yeah, and this is the BC election, which is October 19th. But speaking of elections, Akil, what do we have in store for today's show?
So for today's show, we have a guest from almost the other side of the continent. We have Jackie Shea, whom you had interacted with a while ago, and we have her on the show today.
Yeah, so she's a conservative voter from the United States. And yeah, the purpose of today's episode was mostly to just explore, you know, help us better understand, you know, how maybe more conservative voters from the United States are looking at this election, why some of them are supporting Donald Trump, and, you know, kind of understand that worldview a bit more. Jackie, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Hi, guys.
Yeah, do you want to up your volume a bit?
Let's see. Does that help at all?
Yeah, that helps. Absolutely.
Okay.
We can hear
good,
you
good.
A little bit better now. All right, Jackie. So we wanted to...
Thanks so much for taking me up on this offer. Appreciate it.
Sure. Yeah, I'm pretty excited to get to represent the conservative mindset as a Texan. And I know you have a very different audience, but it's sort of fun to get to interact and tell my point of view, hear what you guys have to think. So that should be good.
Yeah. Looking forward to it.
Fantastic. And one of the things that we like to do on the show is to understand, you know, people's motivations, their life stories, and, you know, how it informs their politics and, you know, if they're activists and their activism. So, Jackie,
yeah.
Where are you from? You know, you said you're a Texan, but is that where you're originally from? What's your story?
Well, yeah, I've been in Texas for a long time, but I grew up in a military family, so we're kind of all over the place, you know. My parents were Pennsylvanians, and, you know, their parents were immigrants or children of immigrants from Slovenia and Greece. But as far as we go, I never lived in Pennsylvania myself, so my parents moved all over the place. My dad was a military doctor, and pretty much as soon as they got married, they started moving. So I was born in Virginia, and then I lived in Colorado for a little while when I was young. And then the bulk of my young life, I lived in El Paso, Texas. So I really have been in Texas for a long time. And then we ended up in San Antonio, which is where I've been ever since. So although I moved around a bit, I do view myself as a Texan for the most part, just because it's where I have grown up.
And seemingly you've spent most of your adult life there too.
Yeah, exactly. I have. So I'm pretty much grandfathered in at this point.
So, you did bring up your parents. You said your dad was a military doctor. What was that his entire career? Did he practice elsewhere? Or was he a military man, his whole career?
So he did 20 plus years in the military. It was the bulk of his career, but he did retire. I shouldn't say he retired. He just started practicing outside the military for a little while. And my dad passed away very young as far as it goes. He was 51, so he was still working. at the time that he passed, and I was 22 at the time. So he, he worked most of the time in the military, and then he had just a little stint at one of the health centers. He was an endocrinologist here in town. I think it was about 5 years he worked outside of the military. And so that was his whole career, mostly military, but medicine from beginning to end.
Okay. Did your mom also have a career? Because I know it's very difficult when you're married to a military spouse because you're moving around so much. So you need to have either a very flexible career or something that you can do, anywhere.
Exactly. Well, she did have a flexible career as far as it goes because she was a nurse. And, you know, there are openings for nurses almost anywhere, as long as you're flexible and willing. So she was an ER and ICU nurse initially when she met my dad. When we were small, she stayed home with us. And then when we got a bit older, she transitioned into school nursing and being eventually a nursing instructor for nurses that were seeking to get their degrees.
Okay, so in terms of your that's your family background, and in terms of education, what did you study?
I studied mental health. So I had originally wanted to go into the more traditional medicine, like my parents. My dad had taken me on rotation, and I ended up with my head between my legs in his office, and he was like, "I'll come back for you, Jackie, because I don't think you're cut out for this." So he finished that rotation, came back, and I knew at the end of that I was not meant to be a doctor in the medical sense, but I decided still to go into one of the helping professions. So I did psychology. So I got my bachelor's in psychology and my master's in community counseling at the University of Texas at San Antonio.
So what is community counseling?
It's basically just mental health counseling. You're a psychotherapist. But you're doing it in, there's different types of counseling, right? So there would be like guidance counseling, which would be more like academic. Community counseling is just the community. So it's group counseling, individual counseling, but it focuses on mental health. And you can do school counseling. I did intern in the schools. So that's another aspect of it. But it would be less academic and more mental health to go into the schools and offer that service.
Yeah, and but you're currently not working in that profession. Is that accurate? And
that's right. Yeah. So I did that for a period of time, and I really loved it. But it was shocking when you actually, you have a concept of something, and when you actually are faced with people's real life problems, it is a whole different thing. It was a blessing and an honor to be able to do it. So I mentioned that my dad passed away young. He had an autoimmune disease, and unfortunately, so do I. So my health took a turn after I had begun counseling. And we decided, my husband and I, to take some time, try to focus on my health, see if we could get me healthy. And then my son came. So the last 6 years, for sure, he has been my sole focus. And that's really when I started the blog, which I think is how I was found online, just so I could still get some of my thoughts out, some of my ideas out.
So, yeah, so you started that blog, and it's called Fair and Biased, and it kind of expresses your viewpoints on the issues of the day. Have you been politically active your whole life, or was there some singular event that took place that really got you more engaged in politics?
I would say it was my whole life. I had mentioned to you in our previous chat that my dad was very involved in writing and speaking from the medical side of these issues. So the life issues were sort of his focus, end of life, beginning of life. And he was the head of Physicians for Life. So he did a lot of that kind of activism. Although, he really focused more on just making people aware. Like, for example, I would assist him at science expos, and we would have fetal development models set up. And this was not that overtly political. It wasn't political at all, although this was political to us as well. But we made sure to keep it not that way. So high schoolers, adults, they could come by and they could just see fetal development from the very beginning to the point of birth. And that was all it was. So he had a lot of actions that were more like that, and I assisted with that. And then he had things that were more overtly political in nature, like he was involved in the Life Chain. I helped with that as well. And then I did that after his death on my own. So that was something I did for a while also. And he wrote for the New England Journal of Medicine quite a bit. They even did a movie back in the 90s, and they got his opinions and interviewed him as the conservative point of view for the movie, which was called One True Thing, I think, and it was about euthanasia. And the movie was actually, I think, in favor of euthanasia, but they wanted to be fair and they wanted to get the other side of the coin. So they had interviewed him for that. So yeah, I mean, that all played a role in my upbringing. And we were, I had mentioned to you as well, we were raised in the Catholic faith, and we ended up later down the road gravitating toward the evangelical side of it, which was kind of a surprise to all of us. But either way, that was a big part of my belief system and the road that I ended up going down eventually. It certainly informs everything that I write and everything that I do to this effect.
So in that vein, what would you say your current involvement is with the Republican campaign? I think you did hear Armand and I at the top of the show talk about how, you know, we've been out door knocking. So what have you been doing?
That's funny. I've not been door knocking, although I did think about it. I have been writing postcards. So I've been writing hundreds of postcards, which is just a very simple grassroots activism. And I've been sending them to Pennsylvania because I don't know if you guys are up on our swing states and the biggest states in this election. Yeah. But Pennsylvania, everybody says, you know, Pennsylvania wins the White House. We'll see if it does or not.
Yeah, most likely.
Yes.
And I have a lot of relatives in Pennsylvania as well. But so I've done a little bit of sending texts, but I'm not really so comfortable with that. After I started doing that, I was like, I don't know, I hate receiving these things. I don't know that I want to send them. So, but I thought, oh, well, postcards are okay. So yeah, I've just been pumping those things out after my son goes to bed lately. And then I have my blog, and I, you know, I just talk about these things a lot online. I just engage with these things online, all these topics.
Okay, how do the postcards work? Do you get a list of voters to write to, or is it just people you know?
Yeah, you get a list. So I was doing it through, there's this activist in Pennsylvania, his name's Scott Pressler. He has an app called Early Vote Action. So with that app, you know, you have to give your information and all this to be able to do this, but they give you lists of voters who are, I'm not really sure how they get the list. Most of the ones I send to are Republicans. It's more a get out the vote effort. Some of them are undecided. And if they're undecided, you know, you're just making your case. You put a few of the main points on there and try to see if you can get them to register Republicans. So that's, they have the list. You see the address. There's several different campaigns. There was a campaign for young men, for Jewish voters, just for regular voters in the various counties. That's pretty much how it goes.
And in terms of the issues, do you gear them only on like the national side, or do you kind of, you know, bring yourself up to speed on what local issues Pennsylvanians are facing and try to attack it that way?
Well, like I said, I have a little bit of an advantage because I have so much family there. So I am in Pennsylvania at least once a year, sometimes more. That helps me because I've actually been in the cities and talked to people that have these concerns, which are really very similar to the ones we have in the rest of the country, although they do have some of their own. For the most part, these campaigns are already like preset on the app. You can choose to use their script or you can go rogue. I do a little bit of both, but it's mostly just depending on who you're talking to. Some of them are a little bit more for the particular counties. I usually choose not to write those because I figure I don't live in that county. I don't want it to seem like I am representing that county if I'm not. So I try to do the ones that are more national in nature.
So pivoting a bit from your biography, we've started talking a bit more politics. So give us the case of why, you know, why do you support, you know, Donald Trump and the Republicans and, you know, in this election? What's the elevator pitch that you have?
So if I was going to do a short elevator pitch on one of these postcards or something, of course I would hit those big things. I would hit economy, immigration, deregulation, censorship.
I don't want to interrupt you, but like for you personally, like it is an elevator pitch.
Right. So it's different for me.
Yeah. So
for you. I know I talked I talked to you, and I've had a complicated relationship with Donald Trump personally. Being a person of faith and evangelical, he was not an obvious choice for any of us. And I have never supported him in the primary when I had another choice. So I was a Rubio voter, and then I would have supported Ron DeSantis, but he was out by the time it came time for Texas voting. But he was the one I was campaigning to get in there. I wanted Ron DeSantis, and I would love to have him in 2028. So for me, it's more like if I was talking to my friends, we're all a little bit less concerned with some of those big ticket issues and more the social issues. And when it comes down to that, it's really less I love Donald Trump and more I don't like what the other side represents. So for me, I think that would be, if I was talking to one of my friends, I would talk about the things I really didn't like about the other ticket.
Can you be more specific on like what social issues, like if you just name three, like what is the three are like fundamental to your vote? Or if it's just one, you can say one, but
it's really probably two. Yeah. The two that are fundamental to our vote. So people like in my community, we are very concerned with abortion. We're on the conservative side of that, you know, the life at conception. That's our belief. So from our point of view, we would like to see as little of it as possible. And Donald Trump has really moderated himself on that issue a lot. More even than people like me would like to see. But the opposite side, Biden and now Harris, there's really no restriction whatsoever. And I feel that's unreasonable. And most of the people that I would be appealing to also feel that that's unreasonable, that we can do better than that. And we can consider at least things we can all agree upon, maybe pain capability, viability, things like that. And, you know, when Harris was a senator, she had voted no. She voted against the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act, which would be basic protections for children born alive from abortions, and the Pain Capable Unborn Child Protection Act, which would be a 20-week protection. I feel like those are things most people in the United States would be in favor of. And so I feel like she's further left than the average. That is what I would appeal on. And then I was talking about the second issue. That would probably be the issue of like women's sports, these transgender questions. Most people in my community would certainly want to be respectful of people that think differently than we do, but we also would want to have a line for our own self and for what we could say about our own beliefs, like within our job, if our job would be at risk because we would not use pronouns either for someone else or for ourselves. That would be a concern that we have majorly. That I think we would appeal both to Donald Trump being on the side of that, closer to our beliefs, and the other side being diametrically opposite to what we think.
So if these two issues, let's just imagine an alternative universe, if these two issues, you know, Donald Trump, and of course, you know, they're very different. Like Donald Trump was instrumental in, removing Roe versus Wade.
Right.
Those protections. Yeah. And Harris wants to, that's a kind of a cornerstone of her campaign, you know, is to bring back those protections.
Right.
And, you know, I think a lot of Americans do support that. If you were to kind of live in an alternate universe, if on these two issues, Harris was to have the same position as Donald Trump, how would you vote then?
You know, so I'm not a single or even a double issue voter. I really am a classic conservative. So even because of other things like tax cuts and some of the foreign policy decisions and the regulation decisions, I would still vote Republican. And also, I've been very concerned about some of Harris's things she said in the past or things she's done that seem to me really quite authoritarian in nature. You know, the gun buybacks that she said she wanted. I know she's changing her view on all these things, but we're talking about, you know, what she said in the past versus now. Things about snatching patents from drug companies. And for the record, I'm not a fan of those drug companies either. I just don't like that precedent. I feel like her nature is to use government to get things in line. She talked about misinformation and how Donald Trump shouldn't be allowed to say certain things on X, like that we need to have regulations on social media for disinformation, but who decides disinformation? All that stuff I'm very uncomfortable with. So I really feel like regardless of the social issues, I would vote Republican unless she came so far toward me on the social issues because I do care more about them. Then I might ignore those other things and I might even vote for her if she was to suddenly reverse herself on those things.
I see. So,
and you had mentioned, just before you had mentioned that, you're also concerned about being against what the other side is doing or what it stands for. And you mentioned a little bit now about, what you don't like about Harris and the Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say value-wise is completely antithetical to you from the Democrats' side?
Yeah, I think it would be primarily the view of life. Of life in the womb. I think there just doesn't seem to be any value ascribed to it from their side. And I know I have friends who are liberal, who are pro-choice, and on an individual level, they might view it very differently. I'm not saying every person on the left, but I'm talking about Harris. I feel like she makes this issue like this is her issue. And this is what she wants everyone to know about her, that she's in favor of abortion, that she's been asked over and over again, is there any restriction you'd put on it? She's never answered it. And as I said, when she had a chance to vote for any restriction on it, she voted no. So this is,
yeah, I think it's kind of fundamental to, to her campaign. And I think a lot of people share the view that like they personally, are uncomfortable about abortion, but they just are also even more uncomfortable with anyone other than the woman or the doctor involved, being a party in those decisions, right? Like, I guess they're just kind of, I don't think anybody is like, oh, I'm so happy, let me go have abortion. It's so much fun, right? Like, that's not, I don't think anybody has that attitude. Like, I think it's more like people think, okay, the moment we put restrictions here, bad things could happen. And the thought process, like if you're ultimately forcing a woman, if you have a law is forcing a woman to do something or someone to do something they don't want to do with their body, that's also like, that's kind of, where I think a lot of people land.
And I know you're right. Yeah. And I know that's why these questions come down to really higher level questions of personhood and of, when we acknowledge personhood, what rights someone has at earlier stages of development, whether they have any rights at all. I think that's also why we can generally agree on some things like later term abortions. Most people in the United States, so when they do polling of this, they do find more people than not that do not want to abolish it completely. But then again, most people would agree that they think it should be regulated at some point, especially toward the end of a pregnancy. So,
and there are regulations surrounding that, right? And there were already, say, protections on the books. You said that you voted against restrictions, but or that they voted against the bill that would have protected a fetus that would survive the abortion procedure. But as I understand it, there was a bill from like the Bush era that protected and basically gave federal personhood to any fetus that survived an abortion procedure. So like that protection is already there. So, as a conservative Republican, what kind of strengthening of that do you expect to see, or what kind of strengthening do you want to see?
Well, for example, Tim Walz, I don't know if you guys have been following this, but in Minnesota, there was a law on the books that babies born alive from abortion needed to be provided life-saving care. And, they also had to be reported if they were born alive. And then that was prior to him becoming governor. When he became governor, along with his state legislature, they reversed this. So now the child only needs to be provided palliative care, which is not life-saving. And it could be as simple as just placing them on a blanket. In general, what that's saying is that you can just let them die now. They don't have to be resuscitated. They don't have to be provided anything, and they don't even have to be reported. So the last 2 years, I think it might be two or three, but, of his governorship, we don't even have the numbers anymore. We had the numbers prior to that.
But the fact that the federal bill is on the books would mean that, you know, that actually would trump his state law. And if you're granting federal personhood, you still can't, you know, violate the criminal code, right? A doctor has to, because it's a federal person, if the federal government is giving them personhood, recognizing them by law, they would have to be given a certain level of care.
Well, like I said, they reversed that in their state very specifically, and there was a big fight in the legislature about taking the wording out that they needed to receive that life-saving care, and about making it so they no longer had to be reported, and the deaths aren't even being reported anymore. So
how frequent do you think these sort of situations are happening?
I think they're not extremely frequent. So I think in the last year that was reported in Minnesota, I think there were 8 on the books. I think it happens more often than that, because since I'm active in this activism, I do read and watch a lot of testimonies from people that left the abortion business, abortionists or nurses. And a lot of times the thing that made them leave was one of these incidents where they saw the child die after the fact. So I'm not saying it's common. I don't think it's common, but I do think it happens. So let's even go with the numbers they provide. Let's say it was 8 or 10, because some years they've had 13. And let's multiply that by all the states. Like, if we heard, even if we had that number, which was just be in the hundreds, if you heard that, you know, 100 babies a year in your country were being left to die, I would think it would be upsetting. And, you know, from the pro-life point of view, you have to point out the hypocrisy here, because we're saying don't let them die on the table, but the real argument is that they would be being killed at all. It's sort of ironic to say try to save them after you just tried to end their life. Yes. So,
and
you know,
absolutely. You know, what you said is completely true. If I heard there were hundreds of babies getting killed, it was very upsetting. But the other side of this is also that, you know, if you heard hundreds of women were dying because, say, they needed a life-saving procedure, that would also be upsetting for your opponents on this issue.
I agree.
And how do you approach that?
Right. So I think most people would, and not all, and I do know this is, you know, something that's come up, but most do really respect the exceptions, and one of them is life and health of the mother. So in some cases, that would be something that comes up, but it's very, very few. In most cases, by the time it's a late term, which is what we're discussing, if we're discussing that, right, you have to deliver either way. So at that point, it's really very rarely.
All these are very rare cases. I want to kind of take the, because we don't have that much time.
Sure.
I want to take the conversation somewhere else. You know, philosophically, and we're going to touch on this in a bit, but I think it's kind of relevant. When we talk about, you know, pro-life, there are many aspects to life, right? And there's an aspect of, I think from my perspective, and something that I think a lot of more people that you would consider, you know, to your left would say, you know, healthcare in the United States is not great. It is one of the, you know, wealthiest countries. It is the wealthiest of the Western countries in the world. But it's the only one not to provide universal healthcare. As a result, it has, you know, significantly lower life expectancy for, especially for men, but both for men and women, than other Western countries. And so, you know, what do you say to someone, hey, I'm also pro-life, but the life that I value is, you know, somebody who's, you know, poor, but, you know, got some condition, and because of not being able to access appropriate medical care, their lifespan is shortened. What would you say to somebody who has that perspective?
Yeah, for sure. I think that's obviously a huge concern, and a lot of people feel that the medical situation in the United States is either not good or broken in some respect. I shared that I have an autoimmune disease. I have a team of doctors. I have lots of doctors, and it's not always smooth sailing, you know, but one thing I'm grateful about is that because of my plan, my medical plan, insurance plan, I can choose my doctor. I can make an appointment tomorrow and I can get in very quickly. And I can get access to the care I need. If my doctor doesn't agree with one of my other doctors, I don't have to wait in line. I don't have to just listen to what they have to say. I get to find another doctor for myself and get the care that I think I can actually be part of. So this is one of my arguments, especially because I live it. But I do respect the fact that the reason I have this insurance plan is because we have a good income. That's not the case for everybody. I do think we need to figure out what to do for the people that maybe don't have a good income. But we've seen a lot of solutions go forward, and they don't seem perfect. You know, I don't think people have been generally really happy with Obamacare. You know, we all know that if you have your doctor, you can keep your doctor, or if you like your doctor, and that really didn't happen.
Well, I think at this stage, like, Obamacare has, like, now become quite popular. Like, 10 years ago, there were all these discussions about death panels and stuff. I remember in 2010, people are saying Obamacare, you know, Obama's imposing death panel. But if even now Trump, you know, didn't really want to say on stage that he wants to repeal Obamacare, right? When mm-hmm. he spent most of his first term trying to repeal Obamacare.
And a lot of what he's trying to do now is to really attack the predatory drug pricing, which I think is good. I think most of us can agree on that. As far as the socialized medicine, I haven't experienced it. The closest thing I've experienced was military. I did grow up with military medicine, which is essentially socialized in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
You get the doctor they tell you to get. You don't have a lot of choice in that. They're pretty quick about getting you in, but not as fast as it is for me on the outside now. And I don't know, you guys can speak to this better than I can, because I think that's more of your system. But I have heard that there's situations you guys run into where you have to wait really long periods of time. And even where maybe they'll close down emergency rooms in certain places overnight because they just don't have, I don't know, the staffing or the funds. You could speak to that better than I can.
So because it's centralized, there's obviously a system to redistribute resources, right? So people can be transferred by ambulance if they need to a nearby hospital. And there's no concern about, you know, whether that's in network or not. And in general, yes, you would experience comparable wait times to the average that you'd see in the United States to here. And the impression that Canadian wait times are much longer in the U.S. is not, it's actually unfounded. But in terms of, you said, you know, you can't choose your doctor. Well, you can. You can actually choose your family doctor. Now, it depends. They may or may not be accepting new patients. But that's just true of any kind of market situation,
right? The doctors here are actually, like, a lot of them run their own practice, right?
Exactly.
So they're not employees of the government. They run their own, it's up to them. It's their prerogative what they want to do.
You guys switch from specialist to specialist as you see fit?
You can work with your family doctor. So if you see a specialist and they tell you something or you don't feel comfortable, or you feel like they're not affording you informed consent, you know, they're just talking at you, for example, you can go back to your family doctor and say, I'd like you to refer me to another specialist. And absolutely, they can do that.
Yeah. Or if you don't like your family doctor, you can go find a different one.
Yeah. That's what I was going to ask. Yeah. It does seem like it's a little bit more difficult of a process, certainly, because we can just bypass all that if we have a good insurance plan.
Which is what the question comes down to, right?
Yeah.
And in fact, this is the question that I think should be put to anyone who thinks the U.S. healthcare system is better than the Canadian system, is that our outcomes are better than the American healthcare system. So, yes, it's true that for certain cases you have to wait longer than you might in the United States, but we still have better health outcomes and we spend half as much as you do per capita. I think a big problem in the U.S. is the fact that it's a patchwork system. What kind of, you know, you said you are conservative, not just on social issues, but also on say economic issues. Would you support a public option? That's a very straightforward question. I think it was posed a few elections ago and it's in the discussion again. Would you support a public option?
I think that's a very good question. This is really, not something I'm as passionate about as some of the other issues. So I guess I would like to hear what they had to say. Personally, I would be hesitant because I can only speak from my own point of view. And like I said, I have a very complicated health history and I'm happy with my care. And it's been very important for me. Like it took them years to diagnose me. It was a pretty rare condition. And I was really only able to do that because I wasn't going to settle for people that were just going to give the minimum. And I was able to switch until I found somebody who would run those tests, and they found it. So for me, that almost feels like signing my own health away, potentially. I'd be very hesitant. But if someone could make a good pitch to me, for, you know, perhaps I'd listen. That's not something I'm as dogmatic about.
But a public option would just, you know, afford someone who maybe couldn't afford who doesn't have an employer plan or couldn't afford a plan in the marketplace. They'll basically get insurance from the government, right, if they choose it. And again, it's about having that choice to do that. So, you know, I'm curious to understand.
I'm not opposed to that. I'm not opposed to that in theory. And I'm not wedded to every single Republican point of view as well.
So, just coming back to this concept of pro-life. So I think, like, for people who are supporting, you know, have been supporting Democrats in recent elections, they've seen attempts to reverse Obamacare. One aspect of Obamacare was the Medicaid expansion, right, which provided health insurance to millions of people that a lot of Republican governors refused to sign on to, right? And I think when we get to this definition of who is pro-life, you know, there are, you know, depending on your beliefs, this system regarding abortion, your religious beliefs, you may have different interpretation of different actions that are taken by, you know, by medical staff in an abortion procedure, right? However, like, if somebody's, you know, creating government programs to provide more health care to poor people, what do you say to those people when they look at, you know, Republicans trying to roll back the health care coverage, trying to block the Medicaid expansion?
I think, you know, the Republican point of view is often that government is very inefficient. And that's what we often come back to. It's like, so often the Democrats, they want these sweeping government programs, and Republicans don't see them doing that effectively. And I'm not against, though, like I said, this really isn't one of the issues that I'm most active in. So I'm listening to what you guys have to say, but it's not one of the things I'm the most passionate about, because I just don't know as much about it.
I think the question I think one person would ask is, like, why would the, you know, the abortion issue, like, why would you be more passionate about that vis-a-vis healthcare for poor people?
I don't think, like, anyone opposes healthcare for poor people. I think we do have a lot of programs in the United States. I feel like it's not like an either or that people don't have access to any healthcare in the United States. If they're a poor person, they do. They have some options. And like I said, I'm not dogmatic about Medicare. I'd even be open to those programs being expanded. I am not one of the Republican governors. So I think that's another issue. But when you talk about pro-life in general, and we're talking about that one issue of abortion, I'd be perfectly comfortable calling it anti-abortion and just handling it from there. And then we could go on to these other issues, because there are so many life issues, so many issues of quality of life. And that's something that I want too for people. I know I've been blessed, and I've grown up in a family where we didn't struggle like this. My mom did, though. You know, she grew up in a very poor family, and she also arrived at a conservative point of view. And that was largely because she felt that so many of the problems in her inner city Philadelphia community were self-inflicted, and were inflicted by people becoming too reliant on the government, to the point where it was like learned helplessness and didn't try anymore to get themselves out. She pulled herself out through education, through getting into a magnet school, which made a big difference for her, which not everyone has access to either. So these are issues that need to be on the table. I can't answer for those governors or even those bills, but I do think Republicans should care about this. And I think, actually think there's a shift in the party. I don't know if you would agree or if you noticed it, but it's really becoming a more big government party than it was before. It's really becoming more focused on health than it was before. I don't know how that's going to play out as far as these particular bills go that you're talking about. I don't see them going over to a fully socialized medicine point of view. And like I said, I don't think that we Republicans generally think that's best. I know you're saying you feel it's best and it has the best results, but we tend to be more about personal decision making and having the right to stray from what the government advises for us.
Which just to be clear, we absolutely do as well. And the surprising thing is that, you know, you said that you are about small government and that is where your conservative values kind of lead you, right? And that's kind of a conclusion of your conservative values. But government is better at certain things because of its scale. So, for instance, on drug pricing, if they're able to negotiate on behalf of, say, the entire system, which is what they do here in Canada, they can go to the drug manufacturer and say, look, we'll buy 1 billion doses. This is the rate that we want to start at.
And they started doing this under the Biden administration, right?
Exactly.
You might be right that that's an advantage. You know, anytime you always give something up and get something, anytime you follow one policy or another. And that might be one of the advantages of your system. Another problem we have is that we are such a large country. Some of the countries that do this really efficiently are really small. Now, yours is not a small country, but population-wise, ours is quite a bit bigger. And we have all these states to balance. It really is challenging to get a system that works for the whole country.
Yeah, I think in Massachusetts, there has universal health care thanks to a Republican named Mitt Romney. I don't know if there's any other state that has universal health care. Moving on.
A big issue in this election, as a result of the last election, is January 6th.
Right.
I want to explore your thoughts on this. But first, I want to ask you, like, do you remember where you were, like, on January 6th, like, what you were doing? Because this is something that, like, to me, I remember very clearly, right? I was driving. I was on the job, actually. I was driving, and then I had the radio on. And I remember that they actually cut abruptly from I was listening to our national broadcasting service, kind of like NPR. We have our own radio station here, and then they cut from music to a reporter basically saying that there was activity at the Capitol. And I pulled over, and I remember pulling up my news app and seeing videos start coming out, which, you know, was really shocking to me because, you know, the United States is the oldest modern democracy in the world, and to see this kind of happen there was quite jarring. So I'm curious, do you remember where you were, what you were doing?
First, I think it's so interesting that you remember. I didn't even think Canadians would follow this that closely. I've since come to realize you guys are very aware of our politics, but I didn't realize it at the time. As for myself, you know, I don't think I remember the day as clearly as you do, but I do remember it. So I remember calling my husband, but I don't remember where I called him from, if I was home, if I was out. I don't remember it that clearly. I do remember being online. I was on X, and I started to see the images come up, and then I turned on the news. And I was just switching back and forth to the different mainstream news channels like CNN, Fox, all of those, to see how they were all covering it. And then I called him, and I said, you know, do you see what's going on at the Capitol? Like, what do you think of this? What's going on? That's my major memory of it. And then, you know, following it throughout the day, throughout the following days, as people did.
So what was your reaction in the days after seeing violence break out at your the democratic symbol of your country?
Right. Well, I thought it was a terrible thing. I thought it was a terrible thing on every level. And from the conservative point of view, it was awful politically, just to put it at the most surface level. I thought, well, this is bad. This is bad for us, especially because we had been saying for months and months and months, complaining about riots and violence on the left. And there had been a courthouse, I think, that was involved in one of these riots. And that was a terrible thing. Now, when you take it to the Capitol, that's a line you don't cross. Obviously, I had seen some images of people trying to break in, but then I saw a video of people just walking in, and I'm sure you saw some of it too. It was like lots of different footage. You see the guy with the horns in Congress, and that was that was almost comical. You saw people walking calmly in, seemingly being allowed in, but then you saw the people banging on the outside. And then I saw some footage when the I forget her name, but, you know, only one, that's a common misconception, only one person actually died that day, and it was one of the Trump supporters that broke into the Capitol. I saw the footage of that little aspect of the mob trying to get through the glass before she got shot. That was terrible. You know, that all made me feel terrible on a national level, and just wondering why these people chose to do this, why they got activated to this level. The protest I had no problem with outside. You know, we are hopefully all in favor of protesting anything that you don't support in the government. These people didn't have faith in the election system. I've shared.
I think, you know, we're on a radio show. We believe in free speech. And, you know, the big issue on free speech here has, and in the States, has been actually about, you know, pro-Palestinian protests being shut down, right? So, you know, free speech is, of course, important regardless, you know, of your point of view. But go ahead.
No, so I was just saying, I felt from the beginning that people that actively broke in should be sentenced, and it should be relatively severe because of the severity of the action. The fact that this was our capital, that Congress was in session, I believe, at the time, had to be evacuated. I mean, that's a serious thing.
Certifying the election, yes.
Right. At the same time, I was never, and I'm still not, in favor of people that were just on the premises, finding themselves with, you know, at the wrong side of the law. I have not been in favor of some of the people I think have been in solitary confinement for indecent amounts of time. I'm not sure I agree with how they prosecuted everyone that was involved or the conclusions they came to, but certainly some of them deserved it. And that's what happens when a riot breaks out. It was incredible. Poor judgment. It is that mob mentality, you know, that is a danger anytime you get people together in these large groups that feel strongly about something. So, you know, from my point of view, it is a blot on Donald Trump on that day, on our side of the aisle, because I think we had taken some pride in not being the rioters up until that
point.
So yeah, it was bad all the way across the board. And as far as Donald Trump goes, I had shared when we were having our chat before that I do not think, from what I can tell, that this was a planned insurrection. Like I said, if it was, I would think that these people would have been armed, that they would have been more prepared to cause more actual damage, that more people would have died. I think it was a spur of the moment, extremely stupid thing to do, and I don't think Trump handled it well. But we have found out in recent days that apparently he did request the National Guard the day before.
But much.
Is that accurate? So what is your source for that? What is your source? Because I looked into that. You mentioned that last time, and I looked into that. I couldn't find any source for him requesting a National Guard or.
That's so funny. I've been seeing it over and over again. When we get off here, I'm going to go look it up, and I'm going to see if I can find the source, because I've just seen it over and over again in the past week or past 2 weeks. That there was some evidence coming out that he actually had requested this. But I'll go double check myself on that. Whether he had or whether he hadn't, I feel more like he didn't purposefully incite this, but that he certainly didn't put an end to it like he should have, like he could have. I didn't like his response with Mike Pence. And that was actually the thing I was most angry at him about, that his response immediately afterward was to go on Twitter and say something about something negative about Mike Pence. So, I was a fan of Mike Pence, you know. He was more meant to appeal to my group.
Yeah.
Right.
So I just coming back to that, like, you know, I want to give you an alternative scenario where, let's say, Donald Trump wins the election by a similar margin that Joe Biden won in 2020. And Kamala Harris believes the election is rigged against her. And she decides not to certify the election. finds an alternative state of electors, certifies those, and attempts to take over the presidency from Joe Biden. In that scenario, like, how would you feel about that?
On the surface, I wouldn't feel great about it. I had been very critical of Trump, although I think it's very hard because I just don't feel that we have a lot of transparency right now. I feel like so just to answer your question first, I guess the question would be whether there was any validity to Kamala Harris's
the same
questions
amount of
about the
validity
election.
That Trump has to his claims. Just exactly
the same amount, right? Well, I would think she had some right to question it. I think there's a lot that still hasn't been fully explained. A lot of audits that haven't been released, and like a lot of the things he brought up, I don't think we've had clarity on that. Some of the things he brought up haven't been proved at all, like the specific Dominion machines.
But just to be clear, like over 60 lawsuits have been lost by election deniers and people who are challenging the election. So there's not a single lawsuit. So, you know, and a lot of these judges are Trump-appointed judges who have found that there was no merit to any sort of questions about the validity of the election.
And some of these were like Republican states like Georgia, right? There was a Republican governor, Republican lieutenant governor, who he called to find him 10,000 more votes. Like if Kamala Harris, you know, was calling, I don't know, the Pennsylvania governor, lieutenant governor, to find her 10,000 more votes.
Right. And I don't want to get too much into all the weeds of it. But as far as the 10,000 more votes, if you listen to that whole conversation, I think it's a lot less damning than that one line. I think he really believed that there were many, many votes that would have been for him that hadn't been counted, or many fraudulent votes that had been. And he wanted to, quote, find the 10,000, but he believed they were really there. I don't think he wanted to produce them from nothing. So I know that often the other side thinks he did.
Whatever he or she may believe, but if they took this course of action, Kamala Harris took this course of action and attempted to, you know, lost a lot of court cases, 60 court cases, but still attempted to certify the original, her original electors refused to be her electors because they believed that the election result was fair. So she found a new set of electors that were not the original ones and attempted to certify those on January 6, 2024.
I think it was a poor decision. And, you know, it didn't reflect well on him. Like I said, a lot of it, and I've mentioned that to you before, I think a lot of it goes to motive. As for those electors they tried to certify, it was really the same thing that they tried to do, that they successfully did in 1960 with JFK, but on a much larger level. And I think it was foolish to try to do it on that level. I think at some point you have to admit defeat, especially when you can't prove it.
I don't think it was the safe thing. In 1960, there was a recount, I believe, right?
It may have been a recount, but at any rate, wasn't it already certified for Nixon, and JFK had almost the same thing drawn up?
No, it was certified for JFK, and then there was a recount, and then it just remained certified for JFK.
I thought it was certified for Nixon. We should check on that.
The point is that there was a recount, and the recount found that JFK actually had won that election. And that's why, in the end...
And I think that's what Trump thought was going to happen. Not necessarily a recount, but he thought he was going to win these court cases. I know you say he'd lost a lot already. He had. But he did not think that he was getting a fair shake in those cases, and he thought he could win enough. I really think he believed he won. And that's the question, whether you think he believed he won or not.
Okay.
And whether his methods were justified regardless, I guess.
No, so, you know, and I think a freedom of speech allows us to believe certain things, and absolutely he's welcome to believe that he won. I think the question in a lot of those cases were whether or not he used his office of the presidency in order to make his belief fact. But what I want to ask you is, you know, you said we're almost out of time, but, you know, you said you wanted to see more transparency in your elections. What does that look like? Because, you know, the United States does have one of the most secure systems because you have paper balloting. Right, you actually have a physical record. There are countries that don't have a physical record, that have different levels of election security.
I would like to see a lot of things, and they're actually passing a lot of laws that I'm excited about, that I'd like to see this time around. And I think it's going to make it more so obviously transparent.
What would you say, like, the top three things you'd like to see in terms of election transparency?
I like that they're eliminating the drop boxes in some of these cities. I just think that's a bad way to do it. And I think even if there's not fraud, it's the appearance of fraud when you can just drop them off in the night in these boxes. I think it's good to get rid of those, certainly. I like that in Georgia, for example, they're making it so that you have to almost like double count it. I think when they have the electronic vote, they also have to follow it up with a hand count. I think, you know, it's going to add time to it, but I like that they're doing that. I like that they're changing some of the laws that if the signatures are inconsistent or wrong, they're going to throw it out. I just think it has to be proper ballot. Things like that. I like to see that we're moving away from the mail-in. I think the mail-in ballots are sort of fraught. It was not the way we did it for years before. Now, I'm not saying we eliminate that, but I like that people are sort of naturally gravitating back to the in-person voting. I think that's good for transparency. I think we need to have more transparency in the polling stations. You hear a lot of complaints about them not hiring an equal amount of poll workers or even rejecting them. That's one thing to not hire them because maybe they weren't even available from Democrats and Republicans, but even rejecting them in some of these cities. I'd like to see like an equal amount. Go ahead.
For sure. And, you know, the poll worker question, right? I think it goes back to what you were saying about you thinking that January 6th was bad. And you know,
yeah,
there is a lot of threats that poll workers have received, which is why a lot of them aren't coming back. Because they're you know, people feel like the election wasn't transparent or wasn't appropriately secure. And there's a right way to do it and the wrong way to do it, right? And I think we can agree that threatening poll workers isn't the right way to do it.
I agree 100%. And I just heard that that allegation actually this week on Megyn Kelly's show. She was interviewing a Democrat activist who made that same complaint. If that's happening, which I'll take his word for it and yours, that's terrible. That should be condemned. What I was complaining about, what I was hearing from the other side, that there were, you know, some Democrat strongholds where they would have like 200 Democrat election workers and 50 Republicans volunteering, and they would be rejecting some of the 50 Republicans. So it was just not an equal representation. I hear in some places, you know, they block out the windows when they're counting. I understand why they might want to do that, but I don't think they should do that. I think we need to sort of crack down on a lot of these things because so much faith has been lost in the system. Whether it was fair, whether it should have happened, it has happened, especially on the Republican side. There is just very little faith that elections are on the up and up. And I think we could return that back by doing a lot of those things on the state level. And certainly, I would agree with you, Trump could have done a lot for that and damaged it a lot also by his claims. But he's just one man. And I think we could handle this on the state level so that it would be much clearer going forward. And I think we're actually taking those steps in a lot of states. I also think you should have to provide voter ID to vote. I've never understood why that's even a question.
Yeah, thanks so much. It's the end of our show. So we're going to have to kind of take a hard ending to wrap things up. Do stay, you know, stay on the line. We'll, you know, continue to talk to you.
Offline. Well, thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for coming on our show. I really appreciate it. The music on the show was composed by the incomparable Sarah Pratt.
Every note she writes is a gift to humanity, elevating our souls to heights we never knew existed. We do have some awesome shows lined up for you with a set of great guests. Do listen and continue to subscribe. You can find all of our episodes on our podcast feeds. Do check them out there. You can also find us at The Armonic Hill on Instagram and Twitter. So give us a like and a follow. If you like the show, please leave us a review on Spotify.
And please vote, folks. Get out and vote. It's super important.
Thanks. Have a good evening.